Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a visiting professor who will be speaking to both University of Tulsa music students and geologists. Well, that sounds rather unlikely on first hearing, but music and geology are the twin passions of my guest today, composer and music entrepreneur Jeffrey Nitsch. Nitsch combined his love into a musical commission, his Symphony No. 1, Formations, a work inspired by the geology of the Rocky Mountains, and a textbook example of musical entrepreneurship needed for musicians in the 21st century. Nitsch is a music professor at the University of Colorado and leads their Entrepreneurship Center for Music. As a composer, his works have been performed by leading American and European orchestras and chamber musicians. He was formerly the managing director of the Pittsburgh New Music Ensemble. He'll be speaking today at noon at the University of Tulsa's Keplinger Hall for the Geosciences Seminar Series, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Jeffrey Nitsch, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as a professor of music at the University of Colorado, and you actually head up entrepreneurship in music at the university, it's interesting you're here at the University of Tulsa for both music, but also for geosciences. Now, how does something like this come about?
Well, I have a background in both fields. I have a dual undergraduate degree in music and geology from Franklin and Marshall College back east, and have always had a love of geology, even though I went down the road of being a professional musician. And last fall in Boulder, I premiered my first symphony, which was a geologically inspired symphony that was commissioned by the Geological Society of America. And so that was finally a chance to bring together these two things.
Now, how would you portray the geologic history of the Rocky Mountains through music? I mean, is it sort of a you know, the obvious example is Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony, but was there a more serious message involved?
Yeah, it was. I wanted to take a slightly different tack with it. There's certainly many pieces of music, as you mentioned, that are inspired by landscape, but I wanted to get into the actual geologic processes that created the landscape. So that was where it was slightly different from other landscape-inspired works. So the first thing I had to decide was I could not possibly tell the whole geologic story of the Rocky Mountains. It was just far too long a story and complicated a story. So I picked specific episodes that I thought would work well together. And then I did a lot of studying of the geology before I began to think about, okay, how would the music reflect that geology? And of course, there is some celebration of the landscape itself. You can't not do that with something as magnificent as the Rocky Mountains. But the basic musical structure is based on the geologic structures.
So give us a sense of how you divine that out. I mean, for example, you're at a wonderful location in Boulder, the Flatirons right near there, and the Front Range, which, you know, this is where the plains meet the mountains.
Yeah.
But of course, if you're going through geologic history, you know, somewhere you're talking about Pangaea and whole dividing of continents and continents crushing into each other. Mm-hmm. So is this the sort of thing you wanted to depict?
That's one of the things, yeah. I mean, definitely wanted to highlight the fact that the modern Rocky Mountains is just the latest chapter in this very long history. So the first movement, for instance, is about the initial creation of continental crust in that part of North America. It's music that is very dark and sort of these long, brooding lines as that initial crust was created. And there were three main episodes of collisions that created that part of North America. And so the first movement has three big climaxes that correspond with each of these major collisions. So that's one way that things were depicted. But also on a more sort of a micro level, there are certain rocks and there are certain rock components that occur and reoccur throughout the Rocky Mountain history. And so those would correspond to musical motives and musical ideas that would, again, come back throughout the piece or would be transformed throughout the piece in the same way that the rocks have been transformed throughout history.
Gives us a sense of the rock types.
Well, one of the main ones featured in the first movement are these igneous and metamorphic rocks that were born out of lava and molten rock solidifying. And that rock keeps cropping up throughout the Rocky Mountain history. So it was formed, the oldest of it, 1.8 billion years ago. And yet we see them in today's modern Rocky Mountains as well. And
this would be like schist and things like that?
There are schists and gneisses and granites. And So all kinds
so,
of
so the granite
a range
that forms
of
the just the bedrock of the mountains.
That's right. This Pikes Peak batholith is one of those.
Yeah, that's almost like a pink granite.
It's a pink granite, and it's a huge, huge, massive rock. That's only about a billion years old. But that's also one of the ones that's featured as
How
well.
How long does this symphony go on?
Well, that's right. It's about 34 minutes, but that, you know, I had to figure out how to handle time. That was one of the big questions I had to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, there's no way to adequately depict, you know, we can't even wrap our heads around geologic time, you know. But what I realized was that geologic time, we can only understand in abstractions. And musical time, we can really only understand in an abstraction. Because once you start listening to a piece of music or any art that unfolds in time, whether it be a film or ballet or even reading a book, you get lost in it. You lose your sense of time. Time becomes a relative thing. And so I thought, well, I'm going to use that to my advantage. And if something happened quickly in a geologic sense, then it will happen quickly in the music. And if something was a longer kind of long sustained gesture geologically, then it will be a long sustained gesture musically. And I found that those things actually worked very well together.
Now, when you have these collision points, were they short in geologic time, or are we talking 10,000 years, 100,000 years, or less?
Well, in geologic time, 100,000 years is fast.
Is it? Yeah.
So,
well, that's true.
You know, we have to be talking about many millions of years before we start talking about something taking a while, geologically speaking.
That's so hard to get your head around. You know, a million years, you know, it's not an incredibly short time of geologic time, but it's pretty short.
Yeah, that's right. So usually the collisions are preceded by a lot of prelude and fugue, as I like to say. And then the main event is actually, geologically speaking, quite sudden.
Yeah. So what were some of the things you wanted to depict in the course of the symphony? You know, obviously the creation of the continental plates and mm-hmm. the continental crust, I guess. And
yeah.
And then what are the other big events?
Well, I sort of worked from the outside in. I knew that first movement was going to be the sort of foundational movement, the oldest rocks in Colorado. And I knew that the last movement was going to be about the modern Rockies, because how could I not end with that? You know, it might be the obvious choice.
So when you're talking about the modern Rockies, how far are we going back here?
Well, certainly the mountains we see today,
yeah,
that started to form about 70 million years ago. So that's a ways back geologically. But then what to do in the middle movements was mm-hmm. where the question was really wide open. And I decided that I wanted to have two movements that were about human history as it has been influenced by geology.
Yeah, the second movement is sort of a Western theme. It has a lot of Western...
That's right, yeah. It's about the gold and silver rushes of the 19th century. And I always use that word plural, rushes, because it wasn't really just a single rush. It was one episode after another, you know, that everyone would rush to this town where there was a big discovery. And usually it was tapped out almost before people arrived.
And they would go to the next
one. And then they would go to the next one.
Yeah.
So that movement is about that history, which was... Again, this sort of start and stop, but also ended with a lot of labor violence and right around the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries. And so that movement ends very sort of violently and dramatically. And then the other interior movement is about fossil fuels. And it's called Requiems. And it's kind of an homage, I guess, to fossil fuels, if you will. I spent a lot of time thinking about the irony that the fuel that makes our modern civilization possible is created out of the remains of previous living plants and microscopic animals, mostly.
Crushed under tons of rock.
That's right. Pressurized
millennia.
And transformed into this fuel. And that there was just something that was sort of poignant about that I thought was worth us reflecting on and just considering. And so it's a contemplative movement. It's a slow movement. And in some ways, I think it's my favorite movement of the symphony. I think it's quite beautiful and peaceful, and stands in contrast to all of this dramatic, you know, these collisions and these uplifts and the gold rush of the 19th century. And then there's this calm movement in the middle.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the fourth movement. And
okay.
You can set that up for us, because you said this is about the creation of the modern Rockies about 70 million years ago?
Yeah, about 70 million years ago or so was a mountain-building event called the Laramide Orogeny. Orogeny is a mountain-building event. And the Laramide Orogeny began with this very kind of slow uplift that didn't create the modern peaks. It elevated the crust, but the modern peaks actually were only carved out much, much later. But the beginning of the fourth movement is about these early stirrings and then this uplift of the original Laramide.
All right, well, let's hear this. This is music by my guest today, Jeffrey Nitsch, who is a composer and assistant professor of music at the University of Colorado. Earlier this season, the Boulder Philharmonic and Michael Butterman premiered his Symphony No. 1, Formations. And he's a guest of the University of Tulsa this week for both music and geosciences. So let's hear a bit of the beginning of the fourth movement. That's music by my guest today, composer and music professor Jeffrey Nitsch, who is a guest of the University of Tulsa for both music and geosciences. Now, what was the reaction from geosciences and geologists, because this was, I guess, commissioned by them? Were they happy with what you came up with?
Yeah.
It sounds like it if you're coming here to talk about it.
Yes, it was commissioned by the Geological Society of America, which is based in Boulder, coincidentally. And they had 125th anniversary in 2013, and so that was the impetus behind all of this. And the response was very positive, and that was a really exciting part of all of this was when it was played at the GSA's convention in Denver last October. And to play it for a room full of geologists who I knew would get all the inside jokes, as it were.
Are there inside jokes?
Well, not inside jokes, yeah, but they would get the geologic story. And the response was really positive. That was a very satisfying.
Now, do you have a detailed program that goes with the symphony? I mean, I would think, since you're talking about these long geologic processes, you would probably have to have a pretty good program for it.
Yeah, it's fairly specific. I came up with not only the specific geologic episodes that I wanted to depict, but representative formations and what time period I was capturing and so forth. So I was able to sort of lay that out for the geologists I talked for about 10 minutes or so before the piece and just sort of give them the quick overview, but so that they knew what was going on. And it was really great because you can sense the energy of an audience when your music is being played. I'm not quite sure how that happens, but I can. And I think most composers do. And I could tell that they were, engaged. And that was a really great feeling.
Well, let's talk about some of your other work, because one of the things you do at the University of Colorado is you teach entrepreneurship for musicians.
That's right.
And, that's a big part of popular music for a long time. But right now we're in this, and really for all musicians, we're in this sort of weird cusp period where we've had sort of a standard way of doing business mm-hmm. as musicians in the electronic age.
Mm-hmm.
And now all the rules are changing. They've kind of already changed, but there's no new paradigm, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of different ways, and it could go in a whole bunch of different ways. It's very confusing because, the old, if you were a popular musician, it's about getting a record deal, and records and touring. Now, you're your own record company more mm-hmm. often than not. That's also changing for classical musicians as well mm-hmm. and high art musicians, jazz and other sort of regional musics. You have to have this element of entrepreneurship in your music making.
That's right. I mean, the traditional music school model in terms of how we go about teaching students.
And this would be like classical musicians, jazz musicians, maybe.
That's right.
Yeah.
That model hasn't really changed in 150 years. It's a Germanic model. It dates back to the 19th
conservatory.
The conservatory model, that's right. And in many ways, it's enormously successful in terms of training great musicians. And we have more talented musicians out there than we've ever had at any time in Western history. But that curriculum has never focused on once you're out of school. That's right. And, you know, 100 years ago, when there were a handful of conservatories and a handful of great orchestras that hired students out of those conservatories, you kind of didn't need any career guidance.
And that's really important to know that.
But now.
Yeah, conservatory in Boston basically provided most of the musicians for the Boston Symphony. New York, the same way.
That's right. And now that's completely changed. And music schools are beginning to recognize that they have got to expand their curriculum and begin equipping students with these skills to negotiate not just the music business in that narrow sense, but in a broader sense, how can we use the creativity that we're teaching to apply to any number of career paths? Because we know that not all music students are going to go become professional musicians, and that's okay if they understand how to translate the things they learned in music school into other disciplines. And so that's the kind of broader agenda that I have as well, is entrepreneurial tools can be applied to any discipline. So I'm trying to teach them those tools and then find out, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do with your professional life? And how can we equip you to go out and accomplish it?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because at one point, you know, the whole struggle was to find a position for, say, an orchestral musician, mm-hmm. to find themselves in a city for a jazz musician or something like that, mm-hmm. where they're the person people go to when they need a sideman or to become a leader and mm-hmm. be sort of entrepreneurial. But mm-hmm. at one point, you know, in classical music, for example, if you were a chamber musician and your chamber ensemble won a prestigious award, the future was sort of set.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a pianist or violinist and you won a big competition, your future as a soloist was pretty much set for a number of years. Now it's because you were going to be signed to a music label, you had to make recordings. Now that all of that stuff is out the window,
mm-hmm.
and even really accomplished musicians that did that years ago who have relied on that model are finding themselves sort of, you know, yesterday's news and having to do all this stuff for themselves, form their own labels. And you even have like Wuhan and David Fink, who have their own recording label.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
And basically have more musicians than they can shake a stick at saying, please record me, because they don't have those skills.
That's right. And one of the reasons why that's changed is there is, as I say, more music graduates than ever. So it becomes a supply and demand question. And even really successful musicians now are likely to be not only managing aspects of their career themselves, as you mentioned, but having multiple components to that career. So maybe they're doing some time touring, but they're also teaching, and maybe they're also doing something else. They're running a chamber group in their own town, or, you know, they're doing these sort of multiple components to their career. And learning how to manage that instead of just reacting to it is another piece of thinking entrepreneurially, so that you can sort of have all of those things complement each other instead of just feel like I've got to have six different jobs just to pay my rent.
Yeah. When you think of like a pianist like Vladimir Horowitz, you know, who was sort of almost childlike, can you imagine him running a festival?
he would need some help.
I can imagine his wife doing it.
Right, exactly.
But I mean, I mean, this is a big thing for musicians, and it's really uncertain where that future is going to go. Mm-hmm. What are the sort of skills that a musician has to have to really make a career in music today, beyond mm-hmm. just musical talent?
Well, I think there's two different categories, and we cover both of these categories in my program at University of Colorado. There are what I call the basic career skills, understanding how the business works, understanding how marketing and public relations work, understanding how fundraising works, how nonprofits operate, just sort of the real nuts and bolts of the business out there. And then where entrepreneurial skills come in are these broader skills about understanding about how markets work and how business models work and how entrepreneurs have to look for opportunities to meet needs that nobody else is meeting. And I think the arts have a really powerful role to play when we look at social issues, educational issues, urban revitalization, these kinds of things where the arts can play a central role, but artists have to learn how to promote their ideas within those contexts.
Well, there's a lot of musicians who would say, you know, urban redevelopment?
Yeah.
What is the role for musicians there?
Well, we know that arts-centered ventures in, for instance, downtowns can help revitalize areas of cities that have previously lain dormant. So artists have to come in and be resourceful and say, well, gee, let me come up with some kind of musical venture, whether it be a venue or some kind of program that allows me to do what I want to do artistically, but also connects me to my community in such a way that I'll be supported in what I do.
A musical homesteader.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a great analogy.
Interesting. Well, how equipped are musicians to do that sort of work? I mean, is it about developing a different skill set?
It is about developing a different skill set. And what's interesting is that many music students think that they don't possibly have those skills. I say, oh no, that's so foreign from what I do as a musician. And I say, actually, it's not so foreign, because it involves creative thinking. It involves analytical skills, which musicians absolutely have. It requires the ability to communicate with other people and collaborate, which musicians are great at. It involves learning how to connect with the people that you're trying to reach, which musicians are good at. So I think actually musicians are natural entrepreneurs. They just don't realize it. And so it's one of the reasons why I feel strongly that as a teacher of arts entrepreneurship, I also need to be a practitioner of it, because I can show, here I am with my work as a composer being entrepreneurial, and look at the results here. And it's not such a stretch. I try to drive this point home to students that they should look at entrepreneurship as an extension of their own creativity, as just a different expression of their creativity rather than something that's completely divorced from it.
Now, we were talking about your Symphony No. 1. That's probably a pretty good example, because you had written works for the Boulder Philharmonic before. But a big work, you know, that's a lot of work. You want to get compensated in some way. And so you had this, Geological Society of America in your hometown. You said, hey, I'll write you a symphony about the geologic history. I mean, this is in action.
Absolutely. And it was really about the core entrepreneurial thing, which is recognize a need that you can fill.
Mm-hmm.
And
they had a big anniversary coming up.
They had this big anniversary. I said, you know, I bet they're looking for some big thing to do to honor their anniversary. And the Boulder Phil, for their part, they were beginning a series of programs that were about what makes Boulder special. So they had started a season that was all about nature and music, because Boulder is a very outdoors kind of place. And as you mentioned, the Flatirons are right there, you know. So I thought, well, this will be something that will work for them and for their mission. So it really was just about bringing the parties together. And that just took me really just exercising the initiative to go to them and say, hey, why don't we do this? And they both said, oh, this is so perfect. Mm-hmm. So it actually was one of the easiest commissions I've ever orchestrated, if you will, because it met the needs of the organizations that were involved. I didn't have to sell them on anything. I just said, why don't we do this? And they were like, oh, that's perfect. And that's what you try to look for.
My guest today is Jeffrey Nitsch, a composer and assistant professor of music at the University of Colorado. He's the director of their Entrepreneurship Center for Music. And he was a guest of the University of Tulsa, speaking to both music and geosciences, as his recently premiered Symphony No. 1, Formations, was inspired by the geology of the Rocky Mountains. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the things you write about, you have a blog on your entrepreneurial web page, is where classical music is and how it's having to evolve. And, you know, you look at this last year, the Minnesota Orchestra was on strike for nearly a year.
Yeah.
We both live in communities or near communities where you've had major restructurings of their major civic arts orchestra in here in Tulsa, the Tulsa Philharmonic, now the Tulsa Symphony in Denver. Denver Symphony is now the Colorado Symphony, but and it's gone through the same sort of turmoils.
Yeah.
Many cities are going through this. And one of the things you write very provocatively is, you know, the idea of the symphony being just the repository for this one type of music, the Western art canon of classical music, what we call classical music, may not, you know, communities may not be able to support it. That orchestra is going to have to be more nimble, more flexible, do lots more things, do different types of music. That's probably gets a lot of resistance.
Well, it does, because you're challenging the status quo, of course. But I think it's imperative. And Just as the educational model we were talking about a little while ago goes back to the 19th century, so does our model for presenting classical music, that it happens at a concert hall. This idea of audiences being very quiet and respectful, that happened only about 100 years ago was when that became the norm.
Right. It used to be party music.
That's right. You know, crowds used to be much more raucous than they are now. And, you know, I have the utmost love and respect for that tradition and that music. It's the tradition that I come out of. But it is really out of sync with the 21st century and with what newer audiences are looking for. And I often get accused of advocating for dumbing down the programming or, you know, just doing light, fluffy stuff or whatever. And that's not it at all. And I think we proved that with the symphony in the Boulder Phil, that here we are doing a world premiere of a new piece of music, and everyone is always allergic to modern music in the concert hall, you know. But they had a record opening night attendance, and the second half of the program had the Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto because they felt they needed to put a war horse on there to sort of balance this radical new piece. And there were a whole bunch of people who came to that concert, heard my symphony, and then said, well, we don't really need to hear the Tchaikovsky. And they left at intermission, which sort of pleased me because, you know, the conventional wisdom is they'll only stay for the, you know, we have to put the war horse on the second half because that will keep them to stick around. But the way we pulled that off and the reason why it worked is the point, which is that we created a piece that was in keeping with that community's sensibilities, this interest in the outdoors, this interest in the earth. And we had a whole bunch of community activities that led up to the symphony. So we had a number of talks that I gave throughout the community for lay audiences of all kinds. We collaborated with the Parks Department, and we had guided hikes up into the foothills around Boulder.
That's incredible.
Where a geologist and I would go out there together, and we would talk about the rocks, and I had this little portable MIDI player and played some musical clips of the rocks that we were looking at. And these hikes were incredibly successful, and they were not normal symphony patrons. They were people who were on the parks mailing list, or they were people from the geology community, you know, in Boulder. And they ended up coming to the concert, people who had never been to a classical concert before. So that's, I think, the kinds of things that you have to do.
Jeffrey Nitsch, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeffrey Nitsch is a composer and an assistant professor of music at the University of Colorado and the director of their Entrepreneurship Center for Music. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa Geosciences Seminar today at noon in the University of Tulsa's Keplinger Hall. It's free and open to the public. We're going to leave you with more music by Nitsch from his Symphony No. 1, Formations. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.